afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Go up and see them if you want a great deal on a John Deere tractor or attachment. They also have mowers. They got the riding mowers, zero-turn mowers. They got a great inventory right now. So go up and check it out. They also have the new Ego electric lawn care line. They have riders and zero turns and handheld equipment. They have the commercial and the residential version handheld equipment. And right now, go up and talk to them about the closeout or special pricing on the last of the gas-powered steel products. They've got some trimmers and line trimmers and hedge trimmers, gas-powered, and thanks to our wonderful governor, you can't buy the new stuff in California anymore, but we are allowed to sell the 2023 additions if we still have them or can get them. If it's manufactured in 2023, you can sell it in California. After that, you're going electric. So go up and see them. They got some closeout pricing on what they have left in stock. Or you can give them a call, phone number 530-226-9226, or check them out online at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da! Nice job, Bill.
Hey, thanks, Aaron.
So let's see, free advertisement of the week goes to... Come on, read my mind. It's only really two places.
I don't know.
Okay, it's either Shasta Pizza... over on Victor that I plan on patronizing later today.
Oh. Because
they're awesome. Or Hilltop Diner, because they are great. And if you haven't been there, it's the old Marie Callender's Hilltop and Mistletoe here in Reading. You should definitely swing in and say hi. Their cooks are awesome. I guess we get to talk a little bit about food with Lier, since she has a little history in food there. Kind of a fun history, too. She has been, Lier Keith, I should be clear there, Lier Keith has been a radical feminist for 40 years and is the founder of WOLF, the Women's Liberation Front. And if you missed that show, it was like, I'll look up the exact date, but a month ago, maybe, we spoke with Sharon Byrne, who is now the executive director of WOLF. So if this sounds sort of familiar, it's similar but different. Sharon suggested we should talk to Lier about how everything got started and all the other things she's been up to. She's the author of 7 books, including The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability, which has been called the most important ecological book of this generation. She's a co-author with Derek Jensen and Max Wilbert of Bright Green Lies, How the Environmental Movement Lost Its Way and What We Can Do About It. She lives in Northern California with giant trees and giant dogs. We'll need to know the type on those. And then, you know, not to bury the lead, but she's also been arrested 6 times for acts of political resistance.
Huh.
Huh. So she's wicked popular.
That's a badge of honor nowadays.
and her name is spelled Lierre, right? So I asked Sharon, I go, how do you say it? Because I don't like to pronounce people's names incorrectly. And she writes back, Leear, right? But Lier actually sends me an email this morning, and she says, oh, and my name? It's Pierre with an L. I was like, okay, I like that one better. So, Lier, where would you like to begin? First of all, we have to know what kind of dogs. Okay, I lied. You don't get to begin. I did. What kind of dogs do you have?
I have Great Pyrenees dogs.
Ooh, you weren't lying. I
love those dogs.
Those are awesome.
Yeah, and they're big, but one of them is actually bigger than me. Duke is, he's enormous. And we haven't been able to get him on a scale because he refuses. I think I'm going to take him to the transfer station in town, and I think they'll let me walk him onto the scale there, but where they weigh cars, you know, the trucks as you're coming and going. I don't know what else to do. He won't get on the scale at the vet, and you can't make him.
No.
And I know he weighs more than me because he can pull me. The other dogs, if it's really like a tug-of-war situation, I will win just because I weigh them. You know, they weigh between 90 and 100. But this guy is like another third size bigger. My guess is he weighs about 160. And he's like a horse.
Yeah.
He's like really the size of a horse.
I should take him to
I'm not exaggerating.
You take him to like the car wash to hose him off? Or how do you, you have like a lot of hair?
He doesn't need much in the way of baths. He's pretty well behaved. He doesn't roll as much. So I pretty much just let him do his thing. He gets groomed. I have a groomer that comes once a month and
brushes
everybody.
Problem
and
solved.
Clips their toenails and all that. But he's very clean. Yeah, he doesn't really need much. He's actually the sweetest dog. And I got him. He was a rescue. He was going to be put down because nobody wanted him.
Oh.
They're really big dogs. Nobody will. I know. Nobody will take him.
He doesn't want dogs.
So big. He's so sweet, though. I'm so glad I went and I rescued him. He's been no trouble at all. So that's my Duke. So
some of those big giant dogs are. My brother has a Black Russian Terrier.
And, oh yeah.
And my nephew has one too, and they're just like these giant, lo-de-do dogs. You know.
Yeah.
Kind of walk around and lay on stuff and want to sit on your lap. And it's like they have no awareness that they're, I don't know, 100 and
enormous.
Whatever pounds. Yeah.
Yeah,
they're gigantic.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of fun. Well, we could kind of run the gamut here on stuff with you. I was kind of curious. Do you mind telling us about the whole food thing? I know that's not really what we were talking about. We were kind of talking about the background on Wolf and the transgender stuff and all that. But I was super curious about this whole vegetarian thing. And I mean, I can't even imagine how much heat you took for that. I don't even think that's the proper way to term that.
Yeah.
They throw blood on you and all that stuff?
They've done some pretty horrible things to me.
I saw pictures of you online with blood dripping out of your mouth like you were a vampire. I assumed those were not real.
Yeah, they love doing stuff like that, too, but that I don't care about, honestly. So, I mean, it's mostly just very juvenile. So,
So,
my history is I was a vegan for 20 years. So, it's very hardcore. I started when I was 16, and I just wasn't going to stop. So, I did permanent damage to my body along the way. It's not an appropriate diet for long-term, you know, repair and support of the human body. We are not meant to be plant eaters. It's just not how we evolved. So, you know, but I was determined. I had sort of, you know, you get into these worlds and then you can't get out. And one of the things about being a vegan is that it really becomes your identity.
Mm.
Like, it's never just what you eat. You know, it becomes who you are. And then the problem is when it starts failing, it is really hard to question that because it feels like it's a threat to yourself, to your very sense of who you are. So I ended up there, you know, where I couldn't get out of it. And all my friends were vegans, or at least vegetarians, and we all accepted this was the best possible diet we should all be aiming for, even if we couldn't always do it. But I was the one that was just, you know, like so hardcore about it. And I owed a lot of people apologies at the end of all of this, because we all know what vegans can be like, and I'm not pretending I was not that way. So, you know, at the end of it all, I was just wrecked, and I had to admit that it failed. So I did start eating meat again and sort of clawed my way back to some kind of health. But it was a long, hard road, and you do spend a year or two just in complete confusion.
I don't know anything about...
True.
I mean, like, I know what vegan is, but, like, what does it do to you? I mean,
Immediately, the first thing that happened was a blood sugar problem, because really all you're eating is sugar. And I want to be clear, I was not a junk food vegan. Like, I was very, very committed to only eating whole grains and beans and all of that. And back in the 80s when I started, there really wasn't a lot of hyper-processed vegan food, so you didn't really have a choice. Like, now when you go to the store to buy that kind of stuff, there's all those weird soy analog fake meat things, which are horrendous, but those didn't exist when I first started. So you really had to just want to eat rice and beans a lot. Like, you couldn't get fake hot dogs and fake burgers. It was all stuff you had to make on your own. So, I mean, in one regard, that's good, because I did not get exposed to tremendous amounts of soy early on. But still, you know, it's not an appropriate diet. So you're eating a lot of sugar. And I thought that I was doing the right thing by eating, quote, complex carbohydrates. But the problem is that it is all just sugar at the end of the day. It's longer chains of sugar, but your intestines, their job is to break that stuff down. So it is a flood of sugar every time you eat.
Mm.
And, you know, we're just not meant for it. So every time you do that, it then provokes insulin as an emergency response. So your blood sugar rises. It's way too much. particularly for our brains. Like, our brains can only function within a really narrow range of blood sugar. If it's too high or too low, you can die. I mean, you can fall into a coma and then never wake up. So it's quite serious, and your body knows that. So the emergency response is insulin. So there's this flood of insulin from the pancreas. And the thing about insulin is it grabs everything. It is a really blunt instrument. So it grabs everything out of everything excess that's floating around in your blood and shoves it into the cells for storage. It just wants it out of your bloodstream as fast as it can get it so that your brain doesn't collapse on you. And then insulin is called the fat storage hormone. And what that means is if there's insulin, a high insulin level present, all of that energy that's been shoved in there for storage, it's locked shut. In the presence of insulin, it can't get back out. And this is why people on these, you know, we've all been told now for decades to eat this high-carb, low-fat diet. And all that's happened is everybody across America has gained weight. And now we have this, you know, quote-unquote obesity crisis.
Right.
And that's why everybody did what they were told. But as long as, it's really simple, as long as you're eating these high-carbohydrate foods that demand insulin, you will never be able to access the energy that you're storing every time you eat. So you're going to be more and more exhausted every year and gain more and more weight. And it's not anybody's fault. Like, people aren't lazy. You know, they don't have a moral failing. They did what the government said.
Yeah.
All of our health institutions said, eat this way. I was told this in school, you know, in the late 70s, as I was deciding to become a vegan. We were told this in school, that if you ate, you know, anything but this high carbohydrate, low fat diet, you were going to die from heart disease and cancer. So everybody did what they were told, and we can see the glorious results, and it's terrible what's happened. Cancer rates have gone up. You know, diabetes is everywhere. You can't call it adult onset anymore because so many children have diabetes.
Right.
Everybody did what they were told, and it's an experiment that they ran on us, on the American public. So anyway, I was running the experiment on myself. So the first thing that happened was within 2 or 3 months of starting this diet, I was having tremendous blood sugar crashes, and I had no way to describe. I didn't know what it was. I had no words for it. I just knew that every few hours, if I didn't put food in my mouth, I felt like I was going to die. And I was. My blood sugar, you know, was too high. Insulin did its job, but now it's too low because insulin, like I said, is a blunt instrument. It's not finely tuned. It will grab everything because it's an emergency. Well, now you've got the opposite problem. Your blood sugar's too low, and your brain is saying, I'm not sure I can do this anymore. You better feed me something. So then you have to put more food in your mouth. And by the time I was done with this lovely process, 20 years on, I was eating just semi-constantly. I mean, it was just a constant graze all day long because I felt like such crap no matter what I did. So I blew through those insulin receptors. I mean, they're never coming back. So, I mean, I now eat basically a carnivore diet, and I feel great. But it's just, I can't ever go back, you know,
carbohydrates. So what was the, I mean, 20 years and you're, I mean, it is, it's kind of a religion, you know. So I,
oh, it was, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so, I can go on, like all the things that happened. I stopped menstruating. I ended up with horrible uterine fibroids. I destroyed my joints, so I have degenerative disc disease. I have very severe pain in my spine that's also never going to go away. Like, I was on fentanyl for 3 years. That's how the level of pain that I'm in from this. And it, you can't repair that stuff once it's gone. Your joints are very, very poorly vascularized. So
I had no idea.
You get this kind of injury, and it's permanent. So I'm going to live in bad pain for the rest of my life. Terrible depression, anxiety, and I know exactly why. Now I understand all of this. Like, I can walk you through every single thing that happened from eating this diet and why I ended up with these weird symptoms. It's all actually pretty obvious, but at the time, you know, I didn't know any of that, and just so many people were in my life were doing this, and the whole world that I lived in, you know, my little sort of political silo, this was, you know, everybody was supposed to be your North Star. Everybody was trying to be vegetarian and vegan. And I just didn't have access to any of the sort of counter information that might have saved me from some of this. And the other problem, of course, is that, you know, most of us now live in urban environments. And that includes me. I mean, I didn't, you know, I always wanted to live in, you know, in a more rural area. I hated living. I hated cities. You know, I grew up in this sort of very urbanized kind of suburban area, and I just wanted to live in the forest was all I wanted. And as soon as I was old enough, I moved to a rural area. But when I grew up, I had no idea where my food came from. And this is true for most people. And this is why vegans can get away with making really ridiculous claims about the nature of animal products and, you know, the environmental so-called cost. And they're wrong about, you know, 90% of it, because they just have no common sense about it because they've never been to a farm. Like, they have no idea what's going on. And I believed so many things just because, you know, I read a book or I saw a pamphlet and it seemed like it could be true. I didn't know better. So it wasn't until much later that I, you know, finally tried to do my own, A, experiments and B, investigations. I was like, I've just been lied to about all of this. Like, none of this is true.
What was the, okay, so what
and
was
life
the,
was a lot more complicated.
What anyway, was the first thing you ate? That was like off the reservation.
When I went off, yeah, I ate a can of tuna fish. And the reason I did that was because it was, well, it was so horrifying to my soul to bring meat into the house.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just like completely horrifying. And I didn't want it to touch my dishes and I didn't want to cook it. And I thought, all right, a can of tuna fish, all I have to do is open it and
like
I can use
it in your mouth.
Fork.
Okay,
well, it's almost like, you know, like having like a kosher, like it was so, it felt like how they talk about trafe, like it was unclean, you know, like I didn't want it in the house. I was like, all right, I won't have to touch my dishes. I can just open it with the can opener. Literally, I used a plastic fork. Like, I don't even want it to touch my fork. And I'll just eat a bite, like, over the sink, you know, and I'll see what happens.
I'm surprised you didn't do it
and
outside.
It was so dramatic.
Oh, my God.
That, I mean, it was instant. It was so dramatic that I felt so much better. I mean, I was shaking all over from head to foot. Like, it was such a battery recharge. And I've heard people call this the meatgasm, like an orgasm, because it's so intense. And it was like that for me. And I had to go lie down for half an hour.
Wow.
Just physically, like, it was so intense. It was like, this is what
it's like little
like
kids when their parents don't give them any sugar in the first birthday party they go to without supervision. They eat a piece of cake.
and they're just shaking.
And they run around for 4 hours. We have to take a really quick break. And
go ahead.
And I just want you to know that my musical choice, I made a guess on maybe what you ate. I was incorrect, but they did write a fun song about it, so I thought we should play it. You're listening to We the People, and our guest is Lee Eric Keith. We'll be right back.
Tried to amend my carnivorous habits. Made it nearly 7 days. Losing weight without speed eating sunflower seeds. Drinking lots of carrot juice and soaking up.
Georgia. I ate the fuzz off a Georgia peach. I plucked me a chicken in Memphis, mama. I still got feathers in my teeth. I ate a pound of pork in Huntsville, Alabama, mama, fine Alabama hall. I went to Dallas, Texas, got the look of the loving of the bone to a Louisiana dog, and they come to me now. All the things to eat now.
Okay, last night I decided to go look for songs about meat, and there was some really funny stuff.
Those are hysterical. I love it.
I was like, Jerry Lee Lewis did a song called The Meat Man. Yep, so that was me at 1 o'clock in the morning listening to The Meat Man.
I didn't know
that was a thing, but it apparently is, and it was hilarious. So, okay, I'm curious, right? So you ate the can of tuna. Was it a secret, or did you tell people you were doing it?
I immediately started telling people because I was not going to live like I had done something shameful. The results were so spectacular. It was like, I'd just been completely wrong about all of this.
You were like
evangelical
about
the whole
thing. So
immediately it was like, well, I'm not a vegan anymore. And then, of course, I had all these people come out of the woodwork and say, yeah, you know, I've been doing this for a while because it failed me too. So then you have like a little group of people all around you going, yeah, I've been through this. It really sucks. And it's a hard transition. So then I spent about 2 years really trying to figure out what was wrong with all of this, because it was supposed to be, you know, the thing that was going to save us from disease. It was supposed to save all the animals. It was supposed to save the planet. It was supposed to feed all the hungry people. Was any of this true, or was it all just wrong? So that was a long 2 years of just reading and researching and experimenting and talking to people and going to farms and just trying to figure all of this stuff out and finding really good books that had been written in the meantime. And I just was wrong about everything. There's no way around it. I was just wrong. And I wasn't willfully wrong. I just had, you know, fallen in with the wrong crowd, and then I just got siloed. And it's a cautionary tale. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, was that I really wanted to make sure that the next generation of idealistic young people, especially teenage girls, you know, had a chance not to fall into the same dark hole that I went down, that there is better information out here. There are ways to eat that will do some of those things that actually are good to repair the planet and do create stronger local economies and do create stronger children and better nutrition for all of us, and in fact create more justice. So it's just not the vegan diet. So it's like I try to tell them, like, your values aren't wrong. I understand why you thought this was a good idea. And we do need a world where, you know, compassion and justice and, you know, questioning human hubris are all, you know, the motivating values toward a better world. But if you really have full information, the vegan diet is not the path toward that. So I had to write a book to explain all that, and I did my best. I still like my book. I think I did a pretty good job. But of course, you know, all the people who are still vegan, you know, now you're the devil. So I like to say that, yes, I'm the anti-vegan. That's kind of like being the antichrist, only with more death threats.
Only with meat.
That's pretty much my life.
Wow. Well, that's, you know, yeah. The thing is, for people who are, who never experimented with that or don't do that, and I get it, there are some people who don't, I mean, it's an emotional thing. There's, I think, a lot of that. Like, I've heard people say, I don't eat anything with eyes.
Yeah.
And I was like, what about potatoes? Are they out too? Like, is that out? But I'm a
Weisenheimer. You can say that as a joke, but plants, I mean, their entire bodies are photoreceptors. They have eyes everywhere.
Right.
It's just literally their eyes. That's what they are, the whole surface of their bodies. They see. And that's why, for instance, if you plant a vining plant, like even just a morning glory or something, in a little pot on your porch, the tendrils will start moving toward anything that they can see that is like will take them up. So they'll grow toward, you know, the post or the, you know, a string, anything that you put up, they'll find it because they can see. And they know they need to climb up to survive. So they're looking for things that go up, and they'll reach onto the porch chair. Whatever is a thing that goes vertical, they'll find it because they can see it. So we can laugh about, oh, yeah, only, you know, mammals have eyes or different, you know, animals have eyes. It's not really true. Like, plants are sentient as well, and they have extraordinary capacities that we don't have. So this was one of my problems when I was a vegan, was I wanted to make this very hard line between, okay, these are the creatures that count, and I'm not going to eat them. I'm going to be compassionate toward them, and they count the way that I count, and they matter. They have moral standing. But I'm drawing a line here, and it's a hard line, and the plants don't count. So anything below animals on this hierarchy, I'm allowed to eat. And then you find out about plants and the ways that they communicate with each other and the ways they help each other and the fact that they can see just like we can. And that all just falls apart. It's like, actually, I think everything is alive. It's not just some of us. So now where am I going to draw a line? And I ended up saying in the book that what I had to come to was it's not a line. It's just a circle. Mm-hmm. And we're all just taking turns. So I'm going to die, and then the plants are going to eat me. And then birds are going to eat the plants, you know, and then that the baby birds are going to eat from the mother bird, and then, you know, they're going to eat the rabbits, and then, you know, it just goes around. Eventually the soil eats us all, and we get recycled back in. But there's not really a line to be drawn. It's just there's this cycle that's the moment of life is always the moment of death for something else. And one of the things that really helped me get through this was I had a friend who's Native American, and this was kind of like almost a joke, right? But it was true that she did have this really profound ancestral wisdom that she was able to help me with, because I was still like all torn up about this. Like, I don't want to hurt living creatures. Why do I have to eat this way? It's clearly helping me, but I really hate it. And she sort of looked at me kind of pityingly, and she's like, you know, for something to live, something else has to die. Like, you should know this by now. You're a grown-up person. And so in her culture, they teach the children this. Like, this is the basis of their whole spirituality and all their religious rituals or saying thank you. And it's a good way to be. It's a very prayerful way. But I didn't have any of that growing up. Like, I didn't know this. And the moment she said it, I looked out at the world and I was like, she's absolutely right. For that tree to live, these animals have to die. And when the tree is going to die, and then the insects are going to eat the dead tree, and then the birds are going to eat the insects, and then the fox is going to eat the bird. I get it. I see it. You know, I live in a rural area. I've got all these animals running around in my yard. I can see what they're eating and what they're doing, and she's right. It's a circle. And it was really a relief. It was like, you know, this burden got lifted off me. Like, okay, I can stop fighting this one at least. It's the nature of just being alive, and that's the basic algebra of existence. So I just have to do it right. Like that's our job as adults, is to do it right.
Well, when you
right? So we do it in that prayerful way. We do it in a way that, you know, we're trying to make the circle stronger. We're not trying to destroy the cycle. Then we've done it well.
Well, I was reading some of the snippets from, I don't remember if it was that book or one of the other ones, but one of the battles that we have up in this part of the state, in Northern California, because we have a lot of beef producers here, independent beef producers, just a lot of ranchers and farmers, and the ranchers are always under the gun for grazing. And a lot of our public land is grazed. And it keeps, you know, the grasses down for fire, it regenerates everything. And I was reading something in yours was talking about the footprint on the land from animals versus the footprint on the land from giant farming that would be, you know, for people who had a plant-based diet. It was actually better for the ground to have a meat-based diet. And I thought, well, you should do commercials up here.
The problem is agriculture. The problem is that, you know, growing annual crops over and over again destroys the soil. And this has been the fate of every civilization that's ever been. There have been 34 civilizations, and every last one of them ends up collapse because they blow through their topsoil. It's an inherently destructive process. And that is not true for, you know, the animal-based ways of life. We started out as hunter-gatherers, right? So for 2 million years, we took our nourishment from inside living communities, mostly in the form of meat. So whether that was fish or whether it was giant ruminants or whether it was eggs and insects, whatever, it was almost entirely meat. And we know this because of the skeletons that have been found, and we know this because of the what they call the stable isotope analysis on the teeth of those remains. You can tell what people ate, and it was almost entirely meat for a long, long time. And this is how we ended up with giant brains. And that can go on forever. There are people who have evolved in place in Africa, and that way of life can go on forever. We, you know, we're the apex predators that hunt the giant ruminants, and as long as we keep them moving, that's our job, is to keep them tightly packed and quickly moving. They do not overgraze. So they need predators to behave well. We all need the whole community in order to be who we really are, and that's sort of another lesson in there. This is not true about agriculture. So 10,000 years ago, in a few places around the world, people took up this entirely different way of life. And what it meant was, instead of taking our nourishment from inside a living community, that entire community is destroyed. So all the plants, all the animals, everything is removed from the land. And instead, you've got this bare ground, and now you can plant a few annuals that humans like. So wheat or corn or whatever it is, rice, but the world has to be destroyed in order to do it. And that's kind of a long way of saying mass extinction, because all of those plants and animals then have nowhere to go. And bit by bit, we have imposed ourselves around the globe. There's no more land to take. Everything that could have been turned to agriculture has been. You know, the farmers took it all. They've wiped out all the hunter-gatherers. And what's left now is just the tiniest little scrap of soil. There's the planet's been skinned alive. And since 1950, what we've been eating instead is fossil fuel. And this is quite grim. People need to understand. I'm not trying to make anyone depressed, but we do have to face what we've done and how bad the situation is. So since 1950, there was a thing that was invented called the Haber-Bosch process, and it is a way to turn fossil fuel into usable nitrogen for plants. And they came up with this in World War II so that they could make bombs. That's where the nitrogen came from. And then after the war, all of those bomb-making factories were turned over to civilian uses, and that meant fertilizer, turning it instead into fertilizer. And this was this huge, like, scientific breakthrough. And I mean, for 100 years, scientists had realized, oh, we're running out of nitrogen. What are people going to eat? And this was this huge panic because nobody knew. And finally, you know, this thing is invented, and it's very energy intensive. But as long as fossil fuel was cheap and available, it felt like it could go on forever. So that's what we've been eating ever since. And when I say that's what we're eating, I mean pretty much every single human being on the planet, if you test the nitrogen in our bodies, half of it comes from fossil fuels. So we are literally eating oil at this point. And it's because agriculture is inherently destructive. You cannot clear the life off the planet and in any way pretend this is sustainable. And these were all things I did not know when I was a vegan. I thought I was eating the peaceful way that was, you know, sustainable and good and wonderful for animals. Meanwhile, it's been nothing but mass extinction across the globe. 200 species go extinct every single day. And this is why we're taking their habitat. They've got nowhere to live because we took all the land. And then we destroyed the land. So it's inevitable. And this is also how it's wrecked human society, because the moment you start down this path, all right, so now you've got agriculture. It creates this temporary surplus. You've got all this grain. Well, the grain has to be stored. The problem is that once it can be stored, it can be stolen. So now you need a group of people to guard the grain, and those people are called soldiers. Now, you can only have a permanent class of people to do that if you're doing agriculture, because in hunter-gatherer societies, you don't have that class stratification. Everybody goes out and gets food and then comes back, and you have just enough basically to go around. But in the agricultural societies, you have this surplus so that the class stratification can begin, and an entire class of people are the war people. They're the soldiers. Also, you've destroyed your land. You're going to have to conquer your neighbors now. You've used up your own stuff. You've destroyed your soil. You've destroyed your trees. You've used them all. You've destroyed all the waterways. They're all filled with soil, runoff from the fields. All the fish are gone. And now you're going to have to conquer your neighbors, or you're all going to starve. So the people who do that, again, are called soldiers. It's now inevitable that you're going to have to do this. So this is the pattern of civilization around the globe. You've got a temporary power center at the middle. It's like a city-state usually, like, say, Rome. And then they conquer everybody in the region, and that goes on for somewhere between 800 and 2,000 years, literally until the soil gives out. So in ancient Rome, everybody's noticing, oh, look, all the mountains are degrading. All the soil is running into the rivers. All the rivers are dirty. And they kept having to extend the port cities, kept having to build out further and further into the sea because all the topsoil was building up there. So they couldn't dock the boats anymore because there was so much soil built up. So then they'd have to build further out. So this goes on and on and on. Eventually Rome collapses, and then it springs up again somewhere else. And that's the same pattern where you're talking about China, India, the Americas. It's the same thing over and over again.
You should come up here.
And then
actually, we have a lot of open land. We have a lot of timber land. We have a lot of really well-run agriculture. And actually, this area is incredibly productive and doesn't look at all like that, only because people have been just incredible stewards. However, it's very interesting. Our government agencies actually require them to do things that would end up like you're describing. But the people who actually work the land push back on that all the time. And they're like, it not only does not work, it will destroy the land and it doesn't produce. But it's interesting because our regulatory framework is set up to force them to do just exactly what you said. It's like, you know, kind of weird. We have to take a really quick break. Sorry about that. 12:41. I'm bad. He's texting or sending me messages. Break. We'll be right back. Our guest is Lier Keith. And, I found a song for men that might not be vegans anymore. So it's kind of a man song for not vegans. And you can find us at, well, should we tell them? Maybe we should be secret.
No,
you can find us at
WeThePeopleRadio.us.
I like my steak well done, potatoes fried, football games on Monday night. It's just who I am, a meat and potato man. I like my coffee black, old TV shows,
My women hot and my beer ice cold. It's just who I am, meat and potato man.
You won't get no dessert till you clean off your plate, so eat it. Don't you tell me you're full, just eat it, eat it. Get yourself an egg and beat it. Have some more chicken, have some more pie. It doesn't matter if it's boiled or fried, just eat it, just eat it, just eat it.
All right, that was crying to be played. I had to do it.
That's hysterical.
that was already in my hopper. But I found the Meat and Potatoes Man last night. I was like, that's kind of a fun song.
Can I talk about the Meat and Potatoes Man for a second?
Oh yeah, sure.
When I was in the middle of writing that book, The Vegetarian Myth, and I remember going to a potluck, and I had, oh gosh, you know, the kind of people that I tend to hang out with, you know, they're all still trying to be vegetarian and vegan, right? And I'm trying to explain to them why this isn't going to work long term. And I would go to, you know, some of these potlucks, and I'm like determined to feed people real food at this point. So I would get local grass-fed beef,
putting stuff,
and I would make this enormous pot of beef chili. Like, there's no rice in it, there's no beans in it. It's literally just beef, some flavoring, some onions, and it's really, really good chili. But it's just solid beef, right? Is what it is. So I bring this enormous pot, and it became known, like in this little circle, that if I'm there, there's going to be real food. And I could hear them in the kitchen going, oh, my God, is she here yet? What did she bring? What did she bring? I'm like, so excited because I know everything else on that table is, like, disgusting corn chips, hummus, you know, like a kind of wilty salad, some crackers. It's just, like, little carbohydrate snacky things, and then, like, that sort of stuff that people who are trying to eat plant-based will try to eat, you know, like hummusy things, like little dips. But no real food. Like, I'm the only one who's actually bringing a pot of food, and they're so excited. So here I am with this, like, enormous pot of, you know, massive beef. And there was this one guy I saw, I don't remember his name, but he, as we're all, you know, we're talking, having a good time, it's a nice group of people, but in the time that the food was sitting on the table, he went back, and I'm not exaggerating, 5 times to refill his bowl with that beef. And I just felt so bad for him. I was like, I don't know, like, who you live with, you live alone, what, like, why are you starving yourself with this ridiculous diet? You're like a 22-year-old guy. He must be hungry all the time. And I have finally given him, like, this tiny little bit of permission to eat real food, and he can't stop. Because he's probably been starving for, like, 4 years now, you know, like, since he left home, where they probably fed him at least some beef. But I just like, my heart broke. It's like, for what purpose? You're not even doing any of the things this diet was supposed to do. It's not doing any of them. You're just hurting yourself for no reason. But he was like, he looked guilty, you know, like the whole time. Like, you do not need to feel guilty because you're alive and you're craving protein. You're a young man. It's what you're going to crave. And it just broke my heart that, like, nobody told him that. Like, he didn't know that. He felt bad about going back to that pot of food. So I just remember that. Like, I just always remember that story, just watching him, like, oh, God, I need more. Like, yes, you need more.
Did you
have muscle mass.
Did
it
you hear
protein.
From people after that? Like, I mean, when did you write the book? I didn't note the year.
It came out in 2010, 2011.
So it's been out a while. So
yeah, a long time, yeah.
So when you go, like, speak or, you know, do stuff like this, you know, radio and stuff, do you hear from people who say, hey, you know what, that actually really helped me. I figured it out. I actually didn't feel good.
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
Every week, yeah.
Converts.
All the time. It's you saved my life. I know I was exactly where you were. It had to be somebody like you who could explain this to me. That's why I wrote it. It's like, I know where they are, and they need a lifeline, and I can give it to them because I know all the reasons they're doing this, and I know why all those reasons are wrong. I figured it out, and if I can just help some of them, you know, come back to health and some kind of sanity, I will have done my part. But, you know, it's a survivor mission. Like, there's this thing in life where if you go through some kind of hardship and you come out the other end, then a lot of times you end up with what's called a survivor mission, where you want to go back to the people who are still there and help them in this, you know, help them out the way they
break
you
them out
to
of the
on your own.
Break them out of
so
the prison.
So absolutely was my survivor mission, and I still, you know, I'll if they write me that note, I will always respond, like, you know, do you need help? You know, I'm so glad you're feeling better, because a lot of times they're still so confused about it. I'll be like, okay, watch this video, read this book next. Here's some better information. Here, go to this website. And I really just try to get them what they need. The ones I feel really bad for are the ones with children, because some of them have really wrecked their kids, and they're starting to realize it.
Oh.
And they feel terrible. Yeah. I'm like, well, children are resilient. You know, it may not be too late. Just feed them as much animal fat as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. Get the soy out right away. You know, no more seed oils. Please, please, butter, butter. As much butter as they'll eat, give them butter. It's really hard. It's really hard. And then there's these ones where it's a divorce, and one of the parents is still like, no, we're vegans. And the other parent is like, we're dying on this diet. And then the kids are stuck right in the middle, and they just don't know what to do. It's really hard.
That's that would be a, that'd be a bad spot. I could see that.
I've seen, you know, I've known people that were vegan, and you know, maybe that's not true in all cases, but they don't look healthy. They don't have good color. I mean, it's
gray. The gray pallor.
Yeah. It's sad.
The first thing I started eating before I ate the actual meat, there was like a year or two where I was eating eggs sometimes. Like I was sort of sliding out of it slowly. And the eggs, day three of eating eggs, I woke up and I went to the, I looked in the mirror, just brushing my teeth, whatever, and my entire complexion had changed. I went from that gray pallor to looking like a healthy person with like rosy cheeks that you might want to mate with. Like I looked alive, and I couldn't, like, I was so stunned. All day long I just kept going back to the mirror. Like all it took was some eggs, and I looked like this. I mean, it was extraordinary.
Yeah.
And my skin didn't hurt, because my skin had been so dry and completely unelastic for so long. I just thought that was normal, but it was like my arms and legs. I could move my limbs, and it didn't hurt. Like my skin could stretch. Just from eggs, just from eating a few eggs every day.
No kidding.
We need animal products. We just need them. Anyway, The vegans hate me. So that was the first group of people that really came for me as a vegan. And I didn't know how bad it was going to be. Even though I was a vegan, I just thought that enough vegans were like kind people who really didn't want a violent world. Like that was supposed to be, you know, sort of the basic theory or like the philosophy. It's like, oh, we're supposed to be good to animals and we're going to have this way better thing where nobody gets hurt and it's all nonviolent and peaceful and blah, blah. And this is just not true.
But like, you cross them and they come after you like a pack of dogs. Yeah.
Oh. So they came for me, and they came for me hard. So I was, you can see this video if you ever want to, but I was giving a talk at a book fair in San Francisco and I was attacked on stage by three vegans. But that was the first assault.
The good
that
news
I had.
Is they have no muscles, so that was awesome, I bet.
Well, they came up from behind me, and like, I didn't even know they were there until they assaulted me. So, it was an interesting thing because I got hundreds of people writing to me saying, this is disgusting, this is so horrible. Who are these, you know, wretched little, you know, how dare they, blah, blah. But my book was number 250 on Amazon sales for like a week. So all they did was encourage people to buy my book.
That's usually what happens. It backfires.
I know. It was
oops.
Like, and all these people, and all these people wanted to interview me. Like, so I mean, all it did was promote me. Like, it didn't stop me from talking either. Like, if they really think that hurting me is going to stop me, they're wrong. I mean, I don't give in to bullies. It just makes me more determined to tell the truth. But I also got a lot of emails from people who were considering being vegan. And they were horrified by it, and they were like, this is not what I signed up for. This is clearly not the community that I thought it was. If all these people out here are, like, celebrating the fact that you got hurt, this is really disgusting. So I'm not doing this anymore. So a lot of people left veganism over it, too. So you don't convince people, you know, by assaulting anybody on, like, that's just not how minds change. I can get back into that vegan world where you're just enraged all the time. The only thing you can feel is either depression or rage. So I sort of get it on that level because your brain just doesn't function, you know, without proper nutrition.
Well, they've decided everybody else is evil and bad, which is how things like that work. I mean, that's not the only, you know, mindset that operates on everybody who doesn't think like I do is evil and bad. The bad part is when you adopt that, you weaken your cause. Your cause becomes less attractive to other people.
Or it just attracts the wrong kind. Yeah, and you're not capable of talking to other people when you're in that state. All you do is yell at them, you know, and you make yourself really obnoxious at every gathering. rather than having an open mind and thinking, well, I know some things, but lots of other people know things too, so let's just sit and talk, and isn't this interesting? Like, wow, I never heard that before. Maybe it's true. You can actually talk to people if you come at it with, you know, actually a flexible mind rather than, you know, a theocratic closed mind, which is what veganism really encourages. So, yeah, so they came after me, and then soon after that, of course, we had the transgender issue came up hard, fast and furious. So, I mean, I pretty much have three groups of people after me all the time, and I like to call it the crosshairs of crazy, because you've got the vegans, you've got the anarchists, and then you have the sort of transgender business. So they're all kind of insane in their own way, and then there's like the Venn diagram where all three of them, it's the same people, and those are the ones you really have to watch out for. So those are the ones who are really...
The trans-vegan anarchists?
Yeah, those are Trantifa, we call them, and a lot of them try to be vegan.
Wait, you call them the what?
There's just Trantifa. I don't know if you've ever heard that.
Trantifa.
Yeah,
I like that.
So you put together transgender and Antifa, you have Trantifa.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, so Trantifa, that's kind of who's after me now. So anyway, that was the very beginning of all this. It was sort of 2009, 2010, 2011, when my book came out, and I was definitely put on the kill list for the vegans. So we were having an event. A friend of mine was organizing in Portland. I live in Northern California like you, but I'm over on the coast. So she was in Portland, and she was putting on an event, a feminist event. And at that point, we could still rent public venues. All of that was to change very quickly. But in 2012, we could still go to, you know, any local space that had a public room for rent, and
sure,
we could rent it. So she rented for us the Multnomah, the Quakers, the Friends Society there has, you know, they got a big meeting house. It's the kind of thing I'm used to renting. You know, they rent their spaces for other groups to use in the neighborhood.
Right.
I've done plenty of events. I've been to plenty of events at Quaker meeting houses and Unitarian churches and places like that. So she rented it, and in 2011, there was a wonderful gathering that we had there. In 2012, she was going to rent it again, and we ran into trouble, because at that point, the vegans and the Trantifa people had realized who I was, and because my name was on the flyer as a potential speaker, they went hard after the meeting house and said, you can't have these people here, and if you do, we're going to burn down your building. And also, it was very specific. We're going to come after you. They were going to throw bricks at my head. That was what they wanted to do, was clobber me with bricks. So that was the first time I had to have private security at an event. And it was a very strange experience at that point. I'd never thought in my life that I would need, like, armed guards to escort me into a talk. Like, what country are we living in?
Yeah.
I had a very hard
time. The intolerant
one. This is really where we are. Now it's just standard. But at the time, it was like, I don't know. This is like Salman Rushdie in England, where he had to live underground for a year and a half because, you know, the fatwa had been put out against him, and the Muslim extremists were coming after him, and the government couldn't protect him. And, you know, there now has been an attempt on his life, and I think he's blind in one eye from that attempt a few years ago. So they managed to get him. But I was like, how is this possible in the United States? That, are you serious? Are you people serious that we're not going to be able to have a public event? So the event went on, but I mean, it was scary, and I did have to be escorted around by these guys. And then also a few weeks before the event, like 2 weeks before, that same sort of group of sort of anarchist whatever people in Portland did throw a Molotov cocktail at a building. It was a bank, and they threw these incendiary devices into the lobby of the bank. So then everybody's on high alert. They're like, well, they kind of mean it. Like, what if... They apparently are very bad at making bombs, because none of it actually, like, didn't. But
lucky.
That doesn't mean they're going to stay bad at making bombs, and maybe that crew was particularly stupid about it. But, I mean, you can find out how to make a bomb on the Internet. It's not that hard. God knows plenty of people around the globe are doing it and, you know, actually blowing things up and hurting a great number of civilians in the process. So, anyway, everything cranked up at that point after that, because our event was, like, 3 weeks later, so... We had to talk to the police and explain the whole thing, and I think it's the same people, and blah, blah, blah. So they're, all right, well, we'll send more cop cars around the neighborhood. But they were like, you're going to have to hire, you should hire private security. So I had bodyguards for the event. So there was just kind of a moment of just, oh, well, all right, I guess this is my life now. I'm not allowed to speak in public, even though we have a First Amendment. And I thought these were values that mattered to people, but apparently not. So...
Well,
then
that's
by the
thing.
Year,
if you don't say what I think, you know, if you don't agree with my position, like, I'm sure there are people listening this morning going, have these guys gone crazy? What are they talking about all this stuff for? It's like, hey, you know what? It's interesting. we live in a world that's kind of interesting. Isn't it fun to hear from people that maybe you wouldn't meet? And once we lose that, we're in deep, deep trouble. That is just not okay. That being said, we get 5 minutes to get some coffee, have a little tuna, you know, whatever it is, whatever it is that floats your boat today, and we'll be right back because we have Lierre Keith as our hostage for the second hour without bodyguards and bombs and whatnot, just, you know, voluntary hostage taking. And you're listening to We the People. You can find the archive of the show later this afternoon at wethepeopleradio.us.
That justice is the one thing you should always find. You gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our...
And welcome to the second hour of We the People. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. They got some great deals right now. They got some closeout pricing on some John Deere tractors you want to talk to them about. If you're looking for a tractor, now's the time to grab it. Spring is right around the corner, so go up and talk to them. Get yourself a brand new John Deere. They also have the new Ego line of electric handheld and riding equipment in stock and ready to go. Or you can give them a call, phone number 530-226-9226, or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. There you go.
And there you have it.
There you have it.
So, you know, we like to do things that are interesting and different rather than always the same stuff and things that you might not hear other places. Things that require a conversation, you know, like the old one-minute interview. Boo. Nobody learns anything in 1 minute. Oh, I guess they might if it was a really short message. Like maybe they knocked you down on a stage because you were saying something. You probably learned a lot from that, Lierre.
Well, what I learned is I learned a lot about myself, which is I did not give in to bullies, so they weren't going to stop me. And then I learned they were bullies. It's like, you can't even sit here and have a conversation with me. All you've got is violence to shut me up. Well, it's not going to work. So
yeah, takes a little.
I kept going. You know,
takes a little more time to actually learn things. So when you were doing, so did all did this when did when did you found the organization, the Women's Liberation Front? When
so
did that start?
That was in 2013. Yeah, that was 20. So it's 10 years old. It was in September of 2013.
So it was like right around that same time.
Yeah, well, that's why. Because what happened was that all of that sort of, like we say, Trantifa, all of that sort of gender, you know, that whole sort of group of them were really coalescing into a political force at that point. And in 2013, that summer... So the summer before, we had had our event in Portland, and I'd had to have the armed guards. The next summer, we wanted to meet in Toronto. It was pretty much the same group of us. And a friend of mine in Toronto has an interesting situation where she is part of it's like an artist co-op. So the whole building is filled with, like, artists' apartments for artists, or like condos, I guess, because they own them. But the street level on the bottom floor is a gallery. So if you live there, you get 1 week a year to have your art displayed in the gallery space, which is a great idea if you're an artist. It's, you know, it's hard to have those shows. So, but that year she hadn't been able to have one because she had injured herself, so she didn't have any work to display. So she said, hey, we're going to use the gallery space for this little conference, and we'll all just meet here, and we won't worry about the Quaker Friends house anymore because they were refusing to rent us any space ever again. So we needed a place to do it. So she said, everybody come to Toronto, and they can't kick me out. I live here. So we'll just have it downstairs on the first floor. And that sounded like a great idea. She said she could fit about 100 people in there. That seems about the right size. So in the lead up to this, two friends of mine were traveling around the country, and they were trying to do like a little mini tour where they were trying to have open discussions about this whole concept of, quote, gender identity and why it was dangerous and destructive and why, you know, there are better responses to this than what we were seeing. and why especially it was dangerous for children to do these kinds of harms to their bodies. And every single one of their stops got canceled. So they were not able to have a single one of their talks that whole summer. Yeah, no, it was horrible. And it was always the same thing, that the venue, whether it was a bookstore or like a church basement, whatever they had rented, would be flooded with these completely deranged, violent phone calls, threatening arson especially. And then they'll do that kind of deep dive into, oh, who works in this place? So it was like a bookstore. Oh, well, on their website, these are the employees. So then the employees would start getting harassed, and then they would find out the employees' children, where they went to school, and then there would be really threatening emails to the employees with like, oh, we know your children goes to such and such school. This is deranged. I just need to say this out loud. Normal people don't behave this way,
even
if it's an idea you really don't like. But this is now standard practice for this particular lovely group of people. This is what they will do. They will come after you. They will come after your business. They will wreck you. And they will make you terrified for your children.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the movement of peace and understanding.
Supposedly, yes, right.
Really not.
I just want, it's like, anybody who's on the left here, I want you to have to face this. Is this really what you wanted? Are these the values that you thought you were espousing? Is this the world that you want, where people are just hounded out of terror for their children's survival because of an idea you might not agree with? Is this really what we were after? Because this is where we are, and there's no point in pretending. These are the people who now are taking control of the culture. And they've got all the institutions. They've managed to get all the universities, the media, everything. This is who is behind it. So,
and that's,
and I've watched it happen over the last decade.
Yeah, it's really kind of scary how this has been accepted as normal. And
normal behavior.
Not a mentally ill problem. And more people are just accepting it, that it's okay to be this way. And it's really not. I mean, it's a terrible breakdown in our society.
Well, it's the left-wing authoritarianism is what it is. And I know there's authoritarians on the right. You know, it's a problem everywhere. Humans can do these things, but this is the left-wing version of it. And I want people who are, you know, identifying as being on the left, who think that they have some kind of progressive whatever, you have to face how bad this is. This isn't just some fringe group who just did this to me for random reasons. Like, everybody I know has been through this now. I've got people, I know people who have lost not just their jobs, but their entire careers as lawyers and doctors. They'll never work again in their chosen field because of this garbage.
Yeah,
and is this really the world that you want?
Yeah, and how do they get away with this? I mean, how does it start, and how does it end up ruining somebody's career?
They do it because no one will stand up to them, and this is the problem with bullies every time.
Hmm.
Like, I think of my friend who's the lawyer, who now has to work in a bank. She will no longer be a lawyer ever again, lost the most wonderful job, she left her job. Nobody in that organization would stand up for her. They were all terrified. It's not even that they didn't believe her or agree with her, but they're like, we're scared of these phone calls. You know, they're threatening all the staff and the staff's children, and we're all terrified. And so, I'm sorry, but we just have to fire you. And they did. They fired her.
Why can't law enforcement step in?
Do something?
And do, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. She called the police. They were calling her house 100 times a day, too. So it wasn't like she didn't file a police report. No one will do anything.
Yeah, it's really
horrible. So anyway, that was happening. So it was 2013, and I'm still like, you know, in this state of shock. Like, is nobody going to stand up and say we're not giving into this? If one person had just stood up, but nobody did, and so they just get like all bullies. They got more and more empowered. Ha ha! We can make everybody do what we want. All the grown ups are just dancing on a string. There was not a single bookstore. You would think bookstores, right? There's supposed to be people who will defend the First Amendment no matter what. They're bookstores, right? That's why they
exist. Exactly.
None of them. Not one of them would stand up for the First Amendment. It was really amazing. I mean, in a horrifying kind of way.
Yeah.
So that happened, and then we were all supposed to be at the end of their tour, was going to end in Toronto at this event. I arrive in Toronto. I get off the airplane. My two friends are standing there. So not only has their tour been just completely, they didn't get to do a single talk. They're like, well, we lost the space that we were, the gallery space is no longer ours. Why? Because the building, the people who own the building got like 100-something death threats and arson threats to the building, and they ended up having to say, no, you can't do this event here. It's too scary. We can't have arson on the building. So then we didn't know what to do because we had like 100 people coming. So very quickly, we had to call everybody who wasn't yet on the way and tell them just to stay home because we didn't have anywhere to put them unless they wanted to rent a hotel. And then everybody who was already there or was already traveling from a far distance, like, we'll just try to figure out where to put you. And we had rented an Airbnb in the neighborhood just for some of the out-of-town people to stay. But, I mean, there was no way it was going to fit 100 people. But, you know, we ended up having, like, 40 who, like, we just had nowhere to go. So we did all pile into that Airbnb just to have, the lectures and the talks and the discussions and then tried to disperse out, you know, more. Like, I rented a hotel room and a bunch of women stayed with me. And then there were other women who lived, you know, close by in Toronto. So they took as many as they could home with them. And people slept on couches and stuff. But it was completely insane. And then the Trantifa band got sent somebody in as like a mole underground. And so she came to the whole first morning of our event and then told them all where we were. So then they came to that house where we were all staying and paraded up and down the street with their horrible signs. And we ended up having, we had called the police at that point about 3 times, but when they actually arrived, we saw all their threats on social media because they were very public about it. They're like, haha, we know where they are. Here's the address. Everybody meet there. We're going to chase them out of Toronto. We had to call the police. The police came. The police went and talked to them. They were told they couldn't harass us, but they did march around the block a few times. But, you know, at that point, they've been threatening arson for like a week, and they're clearly unstable, emotionally unstable. And I know we're not supposed to say that, but I don't really understand why. People who threaten arson are not stable people.
No.
That seems like very self-evidently true.
Yeah.
You are going to threaten an incredible level of harm to people you've never even met because you happen to disagree with them about something. This is not a stable mind state, okay? So, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. We've posted people like at every window. We have like a sentry looking out. It's like if they come back, if it looks dangerous, you've got to give the alarm call. And the thing that I remember that really breaks my heart about that entire weekend was there was a woman there who was brand new to all of this. She'd never been to any kind of feminist event before, and she had such a horrendous life history, like all this serious abuse in her childhood. She'd been on the street since she was like 16. Of course, a horrible abuser found her, groomed her, you know, pimped her out to the sex industry. She had a 9-month-old infant in her arms. She'd managed to get away from this horrible man off the street. She'd found shelter in a women's shelter. She'd been there for about 6 months. She's trying to get her life stable again. Like, all power to her. This is like the most horrible life, right?
Right.
And she's trying to pull herself out, especially for the sake of this, you know, beautiful little baby that she has. She's like 21 years old, right? She comes to our event, and what happens? She's like under threat of her for her life because of these crazy men outside who are demanding that we accept that they're women. And then the arson threats, and like the whole weekend, I just remember thinking so clearly, where is she in the building? How close is she to the door? Because if a Molotov cocktail comes flying through that window, I am making sure she and that baby get out the door. She's first in line. We're getting her out. It's not like there were fire exits. You know, it wasn't safe for us all to be in that small space. It wasn't a public space. We had nowhere else to be because they had shut us out of everything. Anyway, there weren't any Molotov cocktails, but like at a certain point, you know, they make these threats over and over again. And they did try to burn that bank down the year before in Portland. So I don't know. Like, one of them, they say it enough on social media that, you know, it's like every time you see those memes and you hear that kind of rhetoric, you know, anybody who has any, like, resistance left to behaving that way, you know, they're breaking down their own kind of moral compass so that it's okay to do these things to people. Like, that's why that kind of rhetoric is really scary when you hear it.
I know. It's just amazing to me that people don't step back and go, hey, this is a group of men who are threatening women, and let's call it for what it is and do something about it. And law enforcement and basically society as a whole stands back and goes, oh, well, you know, we don't. You know,
must support, must support.
Yeah.
Or you're a bigot, you're a hater, you're a whatever.
Yep.
But I kind of like your you know, overlap of heresy. You know, the vegans, the trans, and the anarchy guys all show
it's
up at Trantifa.
Yeah.
And it's like, huh. Well, that's the thing that's interesting, I guess, part of it, you could say, well, it's depressing. That's why we play funny songs, to try to make it slightly less depressing. But when you look at that, that actually starts to to make sense in a bad way, but for the people looking on going, what the heck is happening? You've connected those three things, and it's like, oh, we're not looking at three different things. We're kind of looking at one thing.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
So that was 2013, so go ahead.
I was going to say, how about this? Before we, let's take our break a little bit, just a few seconds early, and that way we don't have to chop up the idea. But I'm kind of curious where you guys went from that. I like the way this is kind of unfolding. This is a terrific story. Our guest is Lierre Keith, in case you hadn't caught that at the beginning. And I do hope you will share the archive with friends and whatnot. It's all there at wethepeopleradio.us. Here comes my favorite song. My favorite trance song. Oh, here it is. Turn your book into a musical, you can use that one. I think that would be an excellent theme song.
Yeah, it would.
Wouldn't it? It's like, ooh, wow, those words are, like, shockingly appropriate. Okay, so...
So what happened next?
Yeah, so now where do you go?
Yeah, so that was Toronto, so we, you know, faced down the mob in Toronto. So then, the other thing that happened right around then was there's a man in Massachusetts named Robert Kosolek, though he goes by Michelle now, and he murdered his wife. This is disturbing. He garroted her with a wire, and it was such violence that he nearly decapitated her.
Wow.
And he was put. He's decided that his name is Donna, and no, Michelle. He goes by Michelle, and he was put in the women's prison. So he was one of the first ones. Where you've got, it's not just like a shoplifter, okay? This is clearly a deranged, violent, misogynist man. And they put him in the women's prison because he decided that he was a woman. And then eventually he sued the state of Massachusetts and got all his ridiculous cosmetic things paid for by the state. So that was all happening at the time, too. They had put him in the women's prison, I think, at that point. And I was just completely horrified. And it just came to realize very quickly, there are no adults that are going to step into the room. Like, no one's coming to rescue this situation. We've lost all of the bookstores, all of these little venues, all of these sort of normal places where public discourse used to happen are now closed to us. Like, nobody's going to stop doing this. They're going to keep bringing more and more violence, and nobody's going to care. So we need a real way to fight back. Like, there has to be some organized effort. It's not going to work just one by one because we're losing. So why I decided let's try to make an organization that'll take some of this on. So I called a meeting, and a whole bunch of women came to where I live, and we spent the weekend sort of hammering it out, and we decided we would call it Wolf, and that's what we did. So we founded Wolf in September 2013 because we weren't going to give in. So
Well, it really is. It's an attack on women. I mean, this whole movement is an attack on women. You see it. in every venue, it seems like. I mean, look at women's sports. I mean, it's an attack on women. And I just don't get why our society hasn't stepped up and said, hey, enough's enough. This is insanity. And we need to back off this whole transgender idea. If you wanna dress like a woman and act like a woman, that's fine. Go ahead, but don't force it on society, and make everybody else part of your.
Well, we all have to kowtow
dream.
To it, and they get to they have special rights. They can do whatever they want. And
yeah, everybody's afraid to be a hater.
Don't tell them they're not allowed to. Yeah. Strangle people and do all these things. And you see that, I guess, for somebody out there who would say, well, they obviously get punished for it. But I find it fascinating that 9 times out of 10, the media does not, doesn't explain that was part of the process, that this was a man dressed as a woman or, you know, whatever we were
doing.
Well,
I watched a video, a news story last week about a women's basketball team, I believe it was a high school team, playing another high school team that had a transgender on their team. This guy was like 6'2". The girls, I think the tallest on either team was like 5'10". And they went up for a ball. This girl and him had grabbed the ball. And he flung her to the ground, injured her. But when you saw the video, it's like that's a guy throwing a little girl around, and people sat in the stands, and they didn't like it, but you know they didn't do anything about it. It's
there were three girls injured in that that game,
and they forfeited.
Eventually, the coach called it off. Yeah, he's like, my team is just getting wrecked here. Why are we doing this?
So
it was a man or a woman, actually, but whoever it was called it off, and then they had to forfeit. Yeah.
And guess who the bad people were?
And no one will stand up and say, this is insane. We can see this is a man.
Yeah, and the way the article's written, it was like, well, the coach, obviously, you know, he's the bad guy here because he quit. No, that's just the wrong take on that whole thing. It's horrible.
So that was 2013. So that was that's how we got started.
And can't believe it was that long.
Then it was, and then in 2014. So we spent a lot of time just trying to get things together. Like you've got to get a website, and you have to write all your materials. And gosh, what is the admission process? Like, are we going to have members? And should we form a 501c3 nonprofit? Well, that takes a long time, but we should probably do that because we need a bank account if we're going to fundraise money. Because we're going to need money if we're actually going to start doing things like filing lawsuits.
Yeah.
Because you know what those things cost. So all of this is sort of, you know, we've got to get it moving. So we're slowly getting all that together. And then in 2014, we had our first really official event as Wolf. Since it was so clear, we would lose any space that we rented. That, you know, no one was going to stand firm. Like, when you lose the bookstores and the Quakers, there's nobody left to stand for the First Amendment. And when I say Quakers, they really did. I grew up in Philadelphia, right? So I know a lot about Quakers. But they used to be really so strong about First Amendment issues because their lives depended on it. There was a time, and it wasn't that long ago, that you were not allowed to be a Quaker. That Quakers had to flee England because their lives were at stake. They got killed for not being the correct religion in England. And they came to places like Massachusetts. And tried to be free, where they could just worship, you know, according to their conscience. And some of them were hanged in Boston on the hanging grounds. It was a life and death issue. It was, you could be killed for having the wrong religion. This happened on American soil before America was America. And this is one reason why the First Amendment is so important. I don't want to live in a world where people are killed for their religion.
No.
No matter how much I might disagree with them. It's just wrong. And we're supposed to have figured that out by now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's why you used to be able to depend on Quakers. They all knew their history, that they had fled this, you know, horrible oppression, that they still couldn't find safety for decades in America even. You know, that they had been killed for being Quakers. So they were very, very strong about First Amendment issues always. And then all of a sudden, you know, these men turn up and say, oh, you can't let these women rent your basement. And they fold. They completely folded. So we lost the bookstores. We lost the Quakers. I don't know who's left at this point. And then I did remember who was left because my mom was a librarian. The libraries. So it turns out that if you have a public space in a library and you let anybody rent it, you have to let everybody rent it.
Uh-huh.
And the Supreme Court has ruled on this three times, and they have been very clear. Because these are government institutions, they have to be viewpoint neutral. They cannot take a stand on anything. And it could be something as, you know, vile as like the KKK. It doesn't matter. We don't have, you know, official hate speech in the United States. That is not a legal concept. Anybody is allowed to rent that room. If they rent it to somebody, they have to rent it to everybody. So I said, let's do it. Let's go back to Portland, since that's where we're the most hated. We're going to show them that I don't care if they're going to throw bricks at my head. I'm walking into that building, and we're going to rent the public meeting room. So we did. And, of course, the library came under, you know, the usual threats, a huge barrage of nasty emails. The head librarian was actually really great at that point. I know he's not there anymore, so I don't know what it's like there now. But at the time, he was really wonderful, and he would just send them back these really short notes. The correct response to an event you don't like is to have your own event. You are free to rent the meeting room. And that was
it. Clever idea.
He came all day long. He came to our event. He sat there the whole time and took notes. He was utterly bewildered by the end of it. He was like, I don't understand why this material is so... Why are they so mad at you? And I was like, they shouldn't be, but they are. So we did. There was, of course, a group outside that screamed and yelled at us, but they had good security there. We didn't have to hire our own. And we were able to put on our whole event. They were not able to interrupt it so that it had to stop. And we felt like that was a great success. So that was our first like big public event. But since then, we've followed that model a lot. Like when we went to public events, we just jump over everything else. There's no point. It's anytime you try to rent something that's private, you'll get canceled. We have had multiple events in Portland. We've Washington, D.C., New York City, Seattle was huge. That was in 2019. You can watch the videos if you want. It was a huge event. There were hundreds of protesters outside screaming, yelling. It was like a zombie apocalypse. You know, like down, they're pounding on the glass windows. I thought they were going to break the glass.
Wow.
And we had pretty much the entire Seattle police force there protecting us, surrounding the building and getting us in and out. And it was like just absolutely mind-boggling what just the level of hatred they had for us.
Do you get any support from other women's organizations? I don't know whatever happened to national organization.
She's
of
laughing.
Women,
I'm guessing that's a hard pass.
It's been terrible. Like NOW was an early adopter of this whole gender identity nonsense.
Exactly.
They pushed it from the beginning. So they're like the enemy at this point. I mean, they were some of the people who brought this.
What?
And it's just heartbreaking, yeah. They're going to have to change their minds eventually.
Oh, sure.
In a few decades, everyone's going to look back and be like, this was insane, I don't understand it. I had nothing to do with it. So they're all going to pretend that it didn't happen. It's going to be just like lobotomies, you know, where suddenly it was over, and then everybody pretended. Like, oh, no, the entire medical profession wasn't behind this. It's going to be like
not.
In the 50s when they did chemical castrations on gay men. It's going to be exactly like that, where everyone's like, oh, no, I didn't do that. No, some of you did, and the rest of you thought it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
We have these kind of medical scandals just semi-constantly, you know. Thalidomide, when they gave that to women, it ended up, you know, with a really...
Deformed
yeah.
children,
and we still have DES daughters and granddaughters and grandsons, too. It affected the boy babies as well. So we have these, you know, periodically, these fads, essentially, and then everybody has to, you know, kind of re-scramble when it sort of collapses. This will collapse. There are enough losses. It's already collapsing in Europe. That's the good news that everybody needs to know.
I've heard that.
It's already happening. Dutch, the Swedish, Norway, all across the UK, France, they're all saying, all right, put the brakes on. There's no evidence this helps people. It destroys children. What are you all doing? So they've all had to take a huge step back. And some of them have already passed laws that you can't do this to children. At the very least, some of the children now will be protected.
What's the?
It hasn't happened in the United States yet. We are still fighting this battle, but there are court cases that Wolf is involved in and other groups are involved in. It is coming. We have had some really great wins in the court system already. We haven't gotten a lot of press about it, but they're very exciting. So we just have to keep fighting.
What's the justification they use, the actual women's organizations? What's their justification for allowing this to continue?
You know, their public statements are about what you'd expect, where it's the same sort of those mind-stopping cliches. Trans women are women. We're here for all women. It's like there's no such thing as a, quote, trans women, all right?
Right.
There's men and there's women.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with saying that out loud. We're a sexually dimorphic species. Animals are, you know, from billions of years now, that's what we've been doing. And you can't change sex. There are no mammals that can change sex. There's a few fish that are what they call sequential hermaphrodites, and they will change.
Uh-huh.
But that's not us, okay? We can't do it. Nobody can do it. There's no such thing. And, you know, I mean, I can talk about the history of how this happened in psychiatry, because that's a lot of where this started. And so if you want that history, I'm happy to lay that out. But eventually it took over more than just the psychiatric profession, and it took over the medical profession, and then bit by bit, of course, they got the academics, and then now it's everywhere. You know, they spread it everywhere. So,
we haven't talked about the psychiatric part, but, you know, we had Sharon Byrne. We had her on a while ago, mm-hmm. which is kind of how this all got started. I read that article that Jennifer Bylick did back in 2018, and I was like, I got to find her. She's got to come on the radio with us. And I'll tell you what, getting people to come on the radio to talk about this, it's taken me since 2018. And so
wow.
Sharon and Aaron Friday, and then you. But I had a lot of people the other night. I did a meeting in a really rural town, and had Sharon come in on Skype, and I thought this will blow their hair back. It was super funny. About the fifth time Sharon said the word penis, I thought that, like, their hair was, because I could see, like, people going, oh my god, what did she say? But it was really,
really
cute, because then they were like, wait a second, you're right. And, like, normally their meeting is done by like 8:15, 9:30. It's like, get out, you have to go home now, people. But they start figuring out, hey, wait a second, this is a big deal. And then everybody wants to figure out, what do we do with it? But one of the questions was, how does psychiatry, like, rationalize this as an okay thing?
Right.
That was a hot topic.
Well.
So if you have some insight there, we'd love it.
No, I do. I mean, the basic history, it was 1910. There was this guy named Magnus Hirschfeld, who was German. So this is the beginning of psychiatry as we know it. You know, this all started in the very late 1800s. So there's this whole idea that, you know, oh, maybe the brain, maybe the mind, you know, we could make this into a real science and understand the human mind. And, you know, it's not a bad pursuit. There's all kinds of mental illness. Maybe we can help people, or at least even normal people could be helped to be happier than they are. You know, we all suffer. We have anxiety. We have depression, whatever. So I understand the impulse, like, you know, what can we apply? We've learned all these other scientific things. Why not apply it to the human mind? So then you have a group of people who are the sexologists, and they're trying to figure out human sexuality as kind of a separate thing. So it's a sort of a subset of this new science of psychiatry. So this guy, Magnus Hirschfeld, he's one of them. So as early as 1910, he writes a book called The Transvestites, The Erotic Drive to Cross-Dress.
Mm.
So he'd interviewed enough of them that he already
Spicy
got the pattern. That there was this group of men who are absolutely compelled, and they are compelled because it's sexually arousing, that they want to wear women's clothing because they find it exciting, they find it titillating. And the problem is, you know, as we start to talk about this more and more, people get uncomfortable because we have to talk about sex, and then I'm going to say things that sound completely insane, and it's not my fault. I'm just telling you what's out there, okay? I'm not making any of this up. I couldn't make it up if I tried, all right? So that's the beginning of an analysis of this, where this man interviews enough of them that he realizes there's a pattern here. And it's based on, you know, a sexual urge that they seem unable to control, and it sort of takes over their personalities until it's an obsession, and it just ruins their lives.
Hold that thought.
Yeah.
Because we have to have a little free enterprise break. And it just so happens, oh my God, I know you're going to be super shocked. I have two great songs for this.
Oh, good.
I found all sorts of music I didn't know existed. I had such a good time. You have no idea. Oh my gosh. So you are listening to We the People. We are chatting with Lear Keith. And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Nice segue back to the psychiatry. carry on.
I remember that Suzanne Vega song. I remember that album. That was a good album.
I discovered it.
So when we talk about the psychiatry of this movement, I find it interesting that it's now okay. It is a mental fantasy for these people. To now, it's going to be okay to involve children, which, I don't know, I'm thinking ultimately that was what they were going for to start with, but maybe I'm wrong. But look at this whole fantasy at the library with the cross-dressers and story hour. I mean, what's that all about? I mean, that's sick.
It's deranged.
It is.
It's deranged. I don't know what anybody is thinking, and they are going to be very sorry at some point in the future when people look back on this. I was like, they're just going to say, what were you doing? And look at those videos of those horrible men shaking their butts in the faces of tiny children.
Mm-hmm.
It's just deranged. I don't know. I have no other word for this. And the fact that people are letting this happen to children, I don't understand it.
Mm-mm.
So...
No, it's...
Anyway, yes, I mean, they're doing worse than that to children because, of course, they're blocking their puberties and giving them dangerous drugs and then doing surgeries on them. And the whole reason that at least they needed to create this concept of the transgender child. So, first of all, this whole concept of transgender did not exist. In the first half of the 20th century, everyone understood it was transvestic fetishism, that these were men who had, you know, this sort of bizarre sexual urge. And that went on till the 1950s. But what happened was in the mid part of the century, the science of endocrinology developed. So suddenly, science started to understand things like estrogen and testosterone and that these were sex hormones and the effects that they might have on people's bodies. And that's when they start to develop this concept of the transsexual. So before that, that was not a thing. But right around then, when the science makes some of this stuff a little more possible, then they need a concept so that they can start to use it. So that's when they come up with this word, the transsexual. Before that, no one thought that somehow you could be a man trapped in a woman's body, that there was some, you know, mystical essence that could get stuck. And once the science then is there and these medical procedures are there, then they develop the concept. It doesn't come before it. It only comes after it. By the 1960s, there's these support groups set up to support what are now being called either transvestites or transsexuals. In fact, they had a magazine called Transvestia in 1960. It was like a support group magazine that had photographs and stuff. And by 1970, there were 40 clinics in the United States that would give men wrong sex hormones and do breast implants on them and then do these completely horrifying surgeries on their genitals, which I don't even want to describe because it's just so horrendous. But from the very beginning, there were skeptics, and I just want everybody to understand that. There were psychiatrists from the very beginning who said, this is a mental issue. You cannot turn this into a medical problem. People need psychiatric help. There's not a single other psychiatric condition that we treat by doing surgery on people. And, you know, the best...
Not legally, anyway.
The best kind of, like, metaphor or, you know, parallel condition would be anorexia. Like, we don't do liposuction on anorexics. We don't affirm that they're fat and then even remove more body fat from them. We get them help. Like, you wouldn't... It would be completely immoral to do that, and everybody understands that. But in this case, they've all decided that, no, this is the thing people need. So right away, there were psychiatrists who, you know, have put down their feet and said, no, this is completely the wrong direction. They lost. I mean, for now, they've lost. And there were also feminists from the very beginning. So in 1979, Dr. Janice Raymond wrote a book called The Transsexual Empire, and she predicted all of this. She explained exactly what was wrong with their framework, that a woman is not a costume, that a woman is not a collection of body parts that a man might collect. That if men don't like the role that society puts them in, and a lot of men aren't comfortable with it, then they should fight that and decide to be free people and, you know, make a movement that is about human flourishing, to say, look, let's open this up more. You know, men are allowed to cry. Men can play with puppies and kittens. Like, men can learn to knit. Like, you know, have a world that's just bigger opportunities for everybody. That's what feminism was supposed to be about. Like, why do we have to live in constrained little boxes where our behavior is so tightly controlled? Like, that we're supposed to be able to choose more things for ourselves at this point in human history. And the goal here isn't to, you know, reaffirm those boxes, because what the trans are doing is they're just saying, well, I don't like my box, so I'm going to take your box. And so their version of what a woman is everything that women try to fight. So it's this, like, hyper-sexualized, hyper-pornified. I mean, I can talk to you about some of the pornography that they love, that they make. And it's just really horrifying. And they call it sissy porn. And this is going to be disturbing. But, you know, the narrative is that a man gets sort of trapped, usually by some kind of dominatrix person, who forces him to become a woman. And the entire thing is really a subordination fetish. So the fact that he's forced to wear women's clothes and then forced to take estrogen by this overwhelming figure, the fact that he's humiliated by this is what provides the sexual thrill.
Mm-hmm.
So for men, for these men, these specific men, it's so crazy, right? But for these men, being transformed into a woman is the ultimate humiliation, because being a woman is by nature humiliating, is what they say. And they've written entire books about this. Like, I am not making this up. Andrea Long Chu, look up his book. It's called Females, A Concern. He won an enormous prize for this book. He's been published in the New York Times. This is literally his thesis, that being a woman is, you know, ultimately about being completely subordinated, not having a personality, having a blank, black look in your eyes, and being sexually available to any man who wants you. That's what it is to be a woman, and he wants to be that thing, because that's what gives him...
It's at the Harvard bookstore, just in case anyone was curious.
Yeah, no, this is a real book, and it was really, you know, in the New York Times. This is what they say. I am not making this up. I could not make this up. And this is what this movement is. It is a sexual rights movement for these very sick men. That's all it is. Because no normal man believes anything like this about women or wants to do this to his body. No. These are people, I want to have compassion. These people are absolutely suffering. The problem is they're winning, and they're changing laws all around the world so that this stuff will be done to children, and they're putting rapists in women's jails, and I won't have it. So I can't feel sorry for them, but I can't.
No.
They're winning.
Do you think the true women's movement will ever get on board with trying to counter this or shut this down, or is it just too far gone?
I think they're going to have to eventually, but I think it's going to take time, because they have absolutely cast their lot on the other side. So I think it's going to have to be a whole other generation now that takes over those organizations bit by bit and, you know, has the paradigm change. Because that's what happened on the other end. You know, this whole new group of younger women took over, and they had been trained about this in college. This is where they got these crazy ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And they took over, and it, you know, they weren't old enough to know better, I don't think. They haven't had enough life experiences to see that this was just really a pack of lies. So it's going to have to go the other way. Eventually, I think the issue of children is going to win the day, because so many parents now are so upset. And I'm just going to tell you a really brief anecdote about this. Years and years ago, when I was still pretty young and my mom was alive and all this, I remember talking to her about the Vietnam War and asking her, like, when do you think that everybody was against, like, when did it change and a lot of people became against the war? Because I know in the early 60s, most people didn't know anything about it. And then there comes a moment where there's actually a movement against the war. How did that happen? Like, how does that kind of social change take over? You know, like, what's the tipping point? And she said, because she was alive for all that, she said it was when everybody knew somebody who had come home in a body bag. So it wasn't necessarily a family member, but it could have been your brother, but it was the boy next door, it was somebody you knew from high school, it was the kid you dated down the street when you were 16, it was your cousin's son, it was everybody suddenly knew somebody. When there were enough Americans killed and the grief was everywhere, that's when people were willing to say, maybe this isn't the best thing in the world, why are we fighting, why are young men being killed for this, what is this war about? And they were willing to ask questions. And I think it's going to get to that point, and it breaks my heart that all these children are essentially going to be in body bags. They're not going to end up dead. I'm not claiming that. But their lives are destroyed. You cannot put a 10-year-old on puberty blockers and have a normal life.
No.
You definitely cannot put a girl, a 13-year-old girl, on testosterone and remove her breasts and think that she's going to have a healthy life. She won't. She's going to have cancer. She's been thrown into medical menopause. Some of these girls, they're 17, 18 years old. They already have urinary incontinence from the vaginal atrophy. They've had their breasts removed. They will never breastfeed their children. There are already young women who have come out of this cult. They're 23, 24, 25 years old. They are now having their first baby. Their reproductive organs are a mess from the testosterone, and they cannot breastfeed. And they are heartbroken at what they've done to themselves. And they want to know, where were the adults? Why didn't somebody stop me? I was 13 years old. They took my breasts off. And that's the question I have for everybody listening. We have got to stand up and be counted.
Well,
because they're 13 years old. They don't know better.
No,
it's our job as grown-ups.
They're kids, and somebody has to make a decision for them. And the sad part is the...
We don't let kids do any of those other things.
You know, your analogy about Vietnam, you know, everybody knew somebody. Unfortunately, this movement, I forget, I heard somewhere it was like a half of 1% of the population is trans, and yet they have this huge voice and this huge... impact on our society. So I think we have a long, long road ahead of us before enough people get on board with this as a mental illness. I mean, do you disagree?
It's a mental illness, and it's one that is very much encouraged and then produced even by the pornography industry. So that's what we're up against.
Yeah.
It's huge, right? They're just churning these guys out like turbos because they get bored. That's what porn does. You know, it wears down your endorphin receptors. You need stronger and stronger material, more and more extreme stuff. And some of them head down the road toward child sexual abuse images, which is a serious kind of horror. But some of them go this direction, and they get into this, quote, sissy porn stuff. And the next thing you know, they've been turned into this level of just, crazy obsession about this subordination fetish, essentially. They're not capable of having just regular, loving, respectful sex anymore with their partners. They just are deranged, and it's really hard to pull out of. I know very, very few who have ever come back the other way once they get that deep into it, and the porn industry is absolutely responsible for it. And I'm not saying we all don't have agency. You can turn that computer off. Men, if you're out there and this is describing you in any way, shut the thing off. They're after your soul. Like, it only ends in madness.
Well, like, for heaven's sakes, this guy, this Andrew, what's his face?
Long Chu, yeah.
Check that. I just added it to the page for today so that people wouldn't have to go search for it or crash their car trying to write it down. But just in the Amazon book blurb that I included, everyone is female and everyone hates it?
Yeah, like, that's what he says.
That's not even a
because
thing.
Because to be a woman is to be subordinated, because it gives him a thrill to think that. So that's the universe, according to him. But that's like the background kind of theology to this movement. And none of us are allowed to say no, because it's, like I said, it's a men's sexual rights movement. And so women are never allowed to say no to men. And that's why they hate me so much. That's why they've literally come after me with pepper spray. I've been beaten up in the streets over this now. It's like, for what, people? This is it. This is the movement. You want to mutilate children, and you want men to have, 24/7 access to the most deranged porn and destroy their families over it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm going to keep saying no, and I don't want rapists in women's prisons. So I'm here to defend the girls and the women.
And you guys are doing...
I do feel sorry for the young boys who are getting caught up in this, because they're not old enough to know either what's happening to them. This is an incredibly predatory industry, and now the medical industry is climbing on board, because they can make a lot of money from some of these procedures. But can we just say Jazz Jennings, what happened to that poor young man? It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, and crazy.
I am Jazz, you know, that if you've watched the show, it's horrible what they did to him.
Well, all of this, just so people don't skip over it, I included the link to the Women's Liberation Front. And
thank
if
you.
This is a battle that you would like to join and be part of, the lawsuits, Sharon did a really, I'm going to have to do another program with her or you or the both of you about the lawsuits that you guys are doing, because that is stuff that the people who listen to our program would be like, heck yeah, we're on board with that. Absolutely on board with that. The women in, or the men in women's prisons. There are no women who want to be in men's prisons.
There's zero, literally
yeah.
zero.
Yeah, zero yeah. women want to go dress like men and go hang out in the men's prison. That seems like a bad health decision.
Nobody does it.
Yeah,
no,
nobody
it's
does.
It's all
that.
The other way. Yeah.
So you guys are actually suing over that because they are literally
yes, we are.
Prisoners. We we are going to have to run away and thank you and do this again on a different day. Lear, Keith, you have been amazing, and I thought I would send you out with spam, because, you know, that's the meat that everyone loves to hate. Thanks so much for being on with us. You can find the archive at We the People Radio.
Me. Thanks for letting
thanks
me
for coming on.
Rave.
It's a great show.
Yeah.
All right, we'll be back next week with something fun.